Hey y'all, this is Marcus King. You're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fabulous edition of Walking the Floor. I feel like we're right back at it in this new year, man. We took a little break, but we're hitting it hard here at Walking the Floor World Headquarters, bringing you those fantastic interviews that you depend on out there in podcast land. Man, I don't know if you can tell, I feel like I'm getting kind of sick, like I'm kind of dragging ass this week, feeling something. One of my sons been sick all week. I think I might have caught it from him. I might just have the coronavirus. Who the heck knows? If I don't make another one of these things, you'll know it was the coronavirus that downed me. Let's hope not. Fingers crossed. It's also just been, a busy week. Foo Fighters played the Aerosmith Music Cares thing last week, end of last week. There's all kind of crazy stuff going on around the Grammys, you know. And that was a lot of fun. I don't know if that exists anywhere, like on the internet. Maybe people filmed it. I know that they film it at the thing, but I don't know if it ever gets posted anywhere. It was really fun. We got to do a couple of good tunes, two of my favorite Aerosmith tunes. We did Let the Music Do the Talking and Toys in the Attic, and it was really cool. It was fun. A lot of great artists that night. As a matter of fact, Ashley McBride played that night, and my big hope for the evening was that I was going to meet her in the hallway and go like, hey, I'm Chris. I have this podcast called Walking the Floor. Could I interview you? And that never happened. I did walk by her in the hallway at one point, but she looked like she was deep in conversation with some other people, and I didn't want to intrude. So Ashley McBride, if you are listening, consider this an open invitation to come on the show anytime. I would love to interview you. I'm a fan. Okay, so we did that, then had some amazing surf over the weekend, and then played the Prince tribute on Tuesday night that I think is going to air sometime in April or something like that. Anyway, that was really cool. That was kind of mind-blowingly cool. Really, really fun night. And then last night I went to go see Randy Houser and Kendall Marvel over at the Fonda, which that's like 3 nights out in 1 week, which for this old man here is, that's a lot of out of the house time for me, which was all great. It was all a lot of fun, but I'm feeling it today on this beautiful Southern California Friday when the sun is shining and it's like kind of hot, and you know, it's winter, so it's hot. It's Los Angeles, but it's beautiful, but I'm just trying to drink my vitamin C and get through it, baby. Gonna get through it. All right, let's sell some gear. Okay, if you've been listening to this show before, you know about Zounds.com. Zounds.com. Nobody makes the best gear from the best brands more affordable than Zounds. You can split up the cost of your gear over 4, 8, or 12 equal monthly payments. Really simple to make it work for you and your budget, and there's no application process. Yes, it's that easy. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to today's interview. All right, Marcus King, guitar slinger, soul singer, Marcus King, recently stopped by the Walking the Floor World Headquarters days before the release of his great new record, El Dorado, which is out now everywhere. Go stream it or whatever, buy it. It was produced by Dan Auerbach. Lots of records have been produced by Dan Auerbach that I've been interviewing the artists of lately, man. The guy's on a roll. So he wrote it and worked on it with Auerbach in Nashville, of course, and worked with, like, you know, his team of players and songwriters and all that stuff. We talked about, like, trying to get away from the guitar slinger tag that I just kind of reinforced at the beginning of this intro, and the gift of knowing what you want to do in your life and dealing with, you know, stuff like the truancy courts where he grew up wanting to shave his head, and the trials and tribulations of reading Nashville number system charts and everything that goes into making these cool records that he makes out there in Nashville. Also, I just kind of sprung it on him at the end of the interview. I said, hey, you want to play a song? And he did, and it's great. So stay tuned for that. Listen all the way through. This is Marcus King on Walking the Floor. So I think it's, I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but the first thing that popped into my head when I was getting ready to interview you was I grew up in a time of guitar heroes, you know, the guitar hero era, 70s and 80s. And it's like a cruel, ironic joke that I came of age as a player in a time when like alt rock and grunge and shit like that had like outlawed lead guitar playing, you know what I mean? And I've always been like a lead guitar player. So it's sort of like the years of me being a professional musician or whatever, been this time of that not really being allowed. Cause like, you know, it's funny, like lead guitar players in particular seem to bear the brunt of the responsibility in people's minds for like everything that went wrong in hair metal in the 80s. You know what I mean? It's funny. Yeah. But you're what, like 23 years old, right?
Yes, sir.
So you were born after all that stuff. So what was your perspective on lead guitar playing? I'm wondering like if any of that residue was left when you were a kid, when you were first picking up a guitar, and if that had an effect on your playing.
Well, I think, like most musicians who grew up with their parents being musicians, that was my situation. So I kind of took my first opinions of guitar from my dad, and he grew up in the 60s where like Hendrix was like his guy, you know,
right.
And it was still cool then, still very cool. And I think he kind of checked out during the 80s. He didn't really subscribe to any of that like you aforementioned.
So your dad's record collection wasn't littered with like Poison and Motley Crue records?
Nah, not one. I never found one Guilty Pleasure album ever. And I think he was a purist, and he still is. And he dug on
purist of what?
Like the Allman Brothers Band, and you know, he really dug on like Foghat, and he was a blues purist as well. So he turned me on to the blues, and guitar was just an instrument to kind of express oneself, and we never got into the hair metal part of it.
Well, I think like Americana, as broad a sort of genre net as that is, it's like that's where guitar playing lives now. You know what I mean? Less so in sort of mainstream rock.
Yeah.
You know, at least the guitar playing that I'm talking about.
It seems like a solid 16 bars in.
Exactly. They're not like, oh, get 2 bars. And well, maybe we'll cut that in half.
Yeah,
it's interesting. You know, so I'm curious also, do you ever feel like your prowess as a lead guitar player overshadow some of your other strengths, like your strength as a singer, your strength as a songwriter? Because it's certainly like the first thing that people say about you, I think, is your guitar playing. That's the first thing. But then there's all this other stuff to what you do.
I could see that. And I mean, I make steps to avoid that, you know. But people can tend to compartmentalize you. When they hear that guitar is your main strength, they'll... I've never claimed to be a blues artist. I'm a fan of the blues.
Yeah.
I don't consider myself to be one, a real blues artist.
I mean, I hear a lot of different stuff in your playing. Like, who would you consider your sort of primary influences?
It's a mixed bag, really, because I grew up listening to country and western with my grandfather. So, you know, pedal steel players like J.D. Manis and Buddy Emmons were really deep in my ear. And
do you ever work out those pedal steel licks on
regular guitar? Well, I started playing steel for a little while.
Oh, really?
Got really into it for like a year, and then I was like, I'm never gonna do anything else.
Why those guys are so fucking nuts.
They're crazy, but they're so good.
Totally.
And I got really into pedal steel, and I was always really into the Hammond organ. I just, guitar was what felt right to me expressively, but I was really into Miles Davis and John Coltrane, and then I got into like Eric Dolphy. Because that was around the same time that I started going to see like punk shows in people's basements and shit. And at the same time I was studying jazz theory in high school. I was really lucky to go to a arts high school half the day, which is where I learned all that. But at night I'd get my angst out and go listen to punk music, and Eric Dolphy was kind of in that category as well. And Sonny Rollins, I got really into like Bill Evans Trio. That would always really catch my ear. But the Allman Brothers Band was something that I was spoon-fed from a young age. Like I said, my dad really dug all that stuff. And, you know, Derek Trucks Band. You know, anybody that was using the guitar in a way that wasn't derivative to my ear.
I'm curious, what you just mentioned punk rock. That kind of took me by surprise. Yeah, I did not hear a lot of punk rock influence in your music. Like, I'm curious, what stuff were you listening to?
See, there's not really any punk rock influence on my music, per se. But just me as a kid with social anxiety and all these other things going on. To me, going to those house shows, those DIY crust punk shows, it was really special to me. And it's not something that I've ever, like, I've never bought a punk record and, like, put it on at the house.
Just more of a social thing.
I'm open to it, but it was a social hang kind of thing. You know what I mean?
So I haven't heard your whole new record. It's the new record's called El Dorado. I've just listened to what's up on Spotify. Are those all the songs, the Beautiful Stranger, like EP and all the... I notice you keep putting a track up and then another one. Like, now it's like up to five or something. Is that how the record's going to come out?
Yeah, it'll be out completely this Friday on the 17th.
Oh, okay.
But we've just kind of letting a little bit loose at a time.
Right. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a sonic departure from your earlier ones. I have to tell you, that's the only stuff of yours I'd listened to. I didn't even realize until yesterday that you have a ton of records. I thought this stuff that you did with Auerbach was like, that's your debut, but you've got a bunch of other records out.
Well, I was listening
through yesterday, and, you know, it's not like a gigantic departure from what you're doing now, but it is a little bit sonically different. I'm curious how that evolution happened. First off, I'm curious how somebody so fucking young put out so many records so quickly, making the rest of us feel lazy.
No, man, I just like to work. I like to say stuff with my music, and the Marcus King Band, that's kind of always been more of a collaborative thing. Mm. Those are the guys that we all, you know, those are the guys we shared hotel beds and hotel rooms with and slept in vans together, you know? That's my band, my core unit.
And were they not involved in this new stuff?
No, not on this record. It was kind of a departure, you know. I just think it's important for the longevity of a band to be able to do different things.
And so that's something you're going to go back to? I think why I didn't know that you had so many records, because I was looking under Marcus King, and then everything else is under Marcus King Band. It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's the same guy.
If I could do it all over again, it would have been a different name for the band.
Right.
It is a bit confusing, and I dig that. But, you know, for me, it was just a departure. Just like, I guess, Greg Allman doing it with Laid Back after being in the Allman Brothers Band. And I guess Tom Petty did it with Full Moon Fever, right?
Yeah.
So it's something that people do.
Yeah.
And it felt right. And this was also a way to kind of put less of a focal point on the guitar playing and more on the singing and songwriting.
And how did you wind up hooking up with Auerbach? Were you guys friends before you started working together?
Yeah. He just kind of hit me up. I remember I was in Phoenix, Arizona. And some people I was working with at the time called me and said he wanted to just get together and write, see what happened. And I thought that was kind of cool. So I changed all my plans and just went to Nashville. And that's when we started working together, and it became a good friendship then. And then that's also the time I spent there doing that. I really fell in love with the town, and then I moved there.
Mm.
And then we did this record.
That's where you live now.
Yeah.
So, okay, so what, like, how did it go? So he reached out to you about writing, but how did you guys write for this one? I know you wrote with him and with a bunch of, like, big-time, heavy-duty songwriters. Can you talk about that process a little bit?
Yeah, man.
Because I also read that you recorded this thing in, like, 3 days or some crazy...
It was crazy. Fast.
Are you writing and recording at the same time? Or are you writing? Is the writing session one thing, the recording session another?
Yeah, they're kind of two separate entities, you know? All the writing would happen at the kitchen table at the studio, Easy Eye Sound. And he'd just bring in people that he thought would mesh well with what I was trying to say.
Right.
And I guess originally we didn't really have a blueprint for what we wanted to say. We both kind of went in without speaking about it, was just we wanted to throw things at the wall and see what stuck. And what ended up happening, everybody that came in and the ideas I was bringing in that have kind of been like stockpiling up with material that never really worked with my band,
right?
That I didn't know what to do with it. And then I'd bring it to the writing sessions, and it became a reoccurring theme of like a coming of age story. And all these guys, they just really knew how to help me say what I needed to say, you know. They're real architectures, and they helped me build that strong foundation on this record.
Can you talk about that a little bit, like the guys that worked on it with you, that wrote with you, like Paul Overstreet and Ronnie Bowman, Pat McLaughlin, like what are some songs that those guys have written? And those are all like mainstream Nashville songwriter, heavy duty songwriters who've had lots of cuts with lots of people. But what are some of the stuff that they've done in the past that people listening might be familiar with?
Paul Overstreet, he's the guy that like When You Say Nothing at All with Keith Whitley.
Sure.
When you hear that, I think he also wrote like Deeper Than the Holler, or had a hand in doing that. But he also wrote like She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy, you know, by Kenny Chesney. And it's, you know, as silly of a tune that is, it was a big part of my childhood. I grew up hearing that on the radio. And, the rest of those cats have had their hands in so many things, it's hard to really, you know, narrow it down to one thing. And the truth of the matter is, like, I didn't know the depth of these guys' resume before I started working with them. And in a way, I'm really happy I didn't, because when I started looking into it and reading into these guys, I really got intimidated.
But you already had a relationship with them. But I already had a relationship with them, right? Yeah.
And that writing relationship is, you know, it's all really relatable to like dating, really, because that first date can be awkward. And when I'm writing, I try to get deeply personal as I can, because what's the point in doing it unless you're going to say something that you really, really fucking mean? And I would get very real with these dudes real quick, because I've never co-written before. And I think they appreciated that from my approach.
So that was your first time writing with other people?
Yeah. It's kind of a leap. And
What do you think those guys, what do you think their perspective is when they come in and write with you? Because, you know, I have to assume they're used to writing, you know, like you said, like they're trying to get a Kenny Chesney hit on the radio or whatever, and obviously that's not the lane that you're in.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of thing.
Kenny Chesney and I don't have very much in common.
And certainly not much in common in the way that you're marketed or have what your label is, all that stuff, you know, where they're trying to get you airplay and all that sort of thing. So I imagine it's a different, it's kind of different mindset for them too.
Yeah.
I think maybe almost like a something that is a little more, probably closer to their heart. I mean, I don't know these guys, so I don't know.
You
know.
I feel like it's a safe way to say it.
Right.
And what you have is you have Dan, who's a mutual friend. It's really interesting situation that we had, because Dan would bring someone in, and he knows me, and he knows how I work, and, you know, he'd bring in someone like Pat McLaughlin, who co-writes with John Prine, you know?
Right.
And he knows how Pat thinks, and he knows how I think.
Does he write with those guys a lot?
Yeah. He's got kind of a rotating cast of dudes that come through, people who he can really relate with on that kind of level.
I've interviewed recently a few people that have made records with Auerbach, that he's produced their records, like Kendall Marvel and Yola and now you. And it's interesting because there is like the same names keep popping up in each one, you know what I mean? So it's like, it seems like, and I've never even met Dan Auerbach or worked with him or anything, but it seems like he has a really good setup. Yeah, because his records have a, you know, such a great vibe to them, such a great sound, almost like they're all different types of artists and everything, but there's some kind of like common thread that runs through them, which I assume is whatever it is that he brings to it.
Yeah, and I think the writers are a big part of that, and I think the band too.
Who's the band?
So he's got a few, the only remaining dudes from the Memphis Boys, and they were on like the Dusty Springfield Son of a Preacher Man, and they played on like that Bobby Womack stuff,
right?
Which is just insane to me.
Were you familiar with their resumes before you started working with them?
A little more so. I'm a Bobby Womack freak.
I always ask people, and I just think it's interesting, because I've been in those situations myself where it can be intimidating to have a difference of opinion in those rooms sometimes. Yeah. You know what I mean? If you're like, I don't like the direction this is headed. Like, did you ever have any of those moments making the record?
I went into this album process with an open mind, right, much more than I've had in the past. I've always worked well with producers because we did a record with Dave Cobb and Dave.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did a record. My last Marcus King Band record was with Dave Cobb, Carolina Confessions.
Oh, okay.
And he's a sweetheart of a guy, and he pulled a lot of stuff out of me that I didn't realize was there. And working with Dan's kind of the same way. I like to keep a very open mind. And a story that comes to mind is a tune off my last record. I just really hated the direction, and I took it home and listened to it when I went to bed, listened to it when I woke up, listened to it when I hopped in the shower and on the way to the studio, and I got back to the studio and said, safe to say, not a fan. And that was with Cobb.
I've done the research. Yeah. I've made my mind up.
Yeah, I am the focus group. Yeah. We don't approve. And that's how I like to work, and I think I respect that from other people too, is like, I like to give it the college try.
Right.
But if it's not working, let's just not do it. But with Dan, I actually didn't have that, man. It all flowed quite naturally. He's got such a big picture scope from inside that control room, and even when he's playing on it, he can see from miles, and I've always admired that about his approach.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that's like, there's always a couple moments on any record you make, or at least in my case, and I always try to avoid this through exactly what you're saying, but they always songs are like kind of like an evolution, you know, they keep on kind of evolving, you know. Yeah. But it always seems like you get to, like, you know, you've made your record, it's mixed, it's mastered, it's in production, blah blah blah, and then there's like two or three things on there that you're like, just go back in there and kind of rethink that, you know.
There's something beautiful about that too,
right?
Because that's what I like about playing live music, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to have that studio version.
Sure.
I hate to go see someone and it just sounds like they turn on a CD player, you know.
Right.
Make it a little different.
Well, really. That's you just described most quote unquote live touring nowadays, you know.
I like a little in the moment
vibe,
you know.
Yeah. It's just funny. I think people are really conditioned. People are so conditioned to auto-tune vocals and people playing to track that I think it's, you know, it sounds weird to, like, I always I use my wife as a great test case because she's not a musician and has none of the sort of like biases and baggage with it that I do, you know.
Cool.
And so when she will watch somebody play on TV and if it's like actually live, I'm like, fuck yeah. My wife will be like, god, they sound weird.
Yeah.
Like, right. Yeah, it's a human. It doesn't, that's what live humans sound like.
It doesn't sound perfect.
Right. Yeah.
It's not supposed to sound perfect.
Let's back up a little bit. You mentioned growing up and your grandpa playing and stuff. Where did you grow up?
Greenville, South Carolina.
And so what was your childhood like? Yeah, I know you started playing at a very, very young age, right?
Yeah. It was a good childhood. I mean, lower middle class family and just divorced parents. I spent a lot of time, my dad at work, because he was a musician his entire life, and he had... I was born when he was like 44, so he was an older parent.
Was he a working musician?
He was a working musician, and around that time when my sister was born, she's a couple years older than me, he just kind of said, you know, I should probably do something that's a little more reliable, you know. And he got a desk job at that point, and he hated it. And before that, he had many opportunities with different bands, with different record deals, that had kind of gotten shot down just because of, you know, lead singers being assholes.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, just that kind of thing. And he had a really good deal with Capitol Records in Nashville, and the band couldn't get along, and then the guy that brought him on, like, got fired, and then all the bands he brought on got fired as well.
That is the classic major label tale right there.
So there was
what kind of thing? Did he put out records? Are there records out there that your dad
made? Dad was on a record that went out with Polydor Records in 1980 called Perrazzo, and you can find that. There's some really interesting guitar playing on that. It's like pre-glam rock, you know what I mean? It's really...
Now you're talking my language.
I'm saying it's very, like, late 70s Elton John.
Right.
That was kind of that vein. And right. it was this guy, Johnny Perrazzo, who was the lead singer.
Hmm.
And the band was just a bunch of Southern dudes just rocking, like really rocking. And my dad...
And your grandpa was played with Charlie Pride too, right?
Yeah, he had worked with him before. My grandfather played on all the Air Force bases over in like Germany. When he was in the Air Force, he was a staff master sergeant, and he was a musician, and his band would like back up musicians that would come through.
Oh.
And he saw Charlie Pride have a nervous breakdown on stage.
Really?
Yeah.
No shit.
That was a story I always heard. And
like
and
after he was he like the Charlie Pride we know, like successful like, hit making Charlie
was
Pride?
The man, yeah, that's why he was there. He was playing a gig, and the way that I hear the story is my grandfather's band would just back up any solo musician that would come through, you know.
Sure.
Which doesn't seem uncommon for the time.
Yeah, you think of like the bag of tricks you'd have to have as a player,
yeah.
to pull that off.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And my grandfather had some of those. He was a great musician. And he was just a jukebox, too. So
wait, so how did Charlie Pride have a breakdown? What's the story there?
Well, I mean, after I've had a couple out there on the road, I get it now. The story makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
You know, you just work yourself into exhaustion.
Sure.
And it's always, you know, that's just part of it. If that's what fulfills you,
yeah.
mostly is just working and just traveling.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know why I was thinking. Oh, I know why. Because I was cleaning out my garage this week, and I found a concert poster from when I opened up earlier last year. I opened up, got to open up for Blackberry Smoke at the Ryman.
Cool.
Which was like amazing, and it was the last show of the day. So it was like this, you know, thing off in the distance with the whole time you're kind of working towards. And we had played New Orleans the night before, and we were in the bus. You know, we're just in a van.
Mm-hmm.
So drove hours after the show and then slept for a couple hours at some shitty hotel and then drove all day and we got there and drive up to the back door and the guy working at the Ryman, who I don't know who he was or what his job was, but the guy working the back door was just such a fucking dick.
Yeah.
That it just like, that was my breakdown day.
Oh yeah.
It's like those days always happen. It's always you bump into one of those motherfuckers on the day that you got no sleep and
yeah.
no food and you drove all day, you know?
They almost seem like placed there
yeah.
by something.
Totally. They're like, oh, fuck, man, I really made an ass of myself. Damn.
Yeah.
And this was the special show, too.
Exactly. It's always the special show.
So when did, did you get, like, a lot of guitar playing tips from your dad and your grandpa? Was it just unspoken, or did they sit down with you and play with you?
They'd sit down with me and give me lessons, and they'd just kind of teach me the way that they do it. It was pretty simple, broad stroke kind of lessons in my household, which was like, don't be an asshole, don't get a big head.
I like that starts before this is an A chord. This is an yeah, E chord.
Doesn't matter. The main rules were, no matter how good you are, this was my grandfather speaking, no matter how good you are, there's someone younger and hungrier and more talented and ready to do it for cheaper.
Yeah, so. You're the embodiment of that right now. Maybe not the cheaper part, but younger and hungrier.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, there's no reason to get a big head, and I'm really so happy that I had those lessons early on.
So when did it go from, like, just, you know, childhood thing that you were into to, like, this is what I'm going to do? Because it must have happened pretty young for you, because, like I said, you're 23 and you already have a group of records out.
It was great, man. I had such a great support system with my family, and I was also going to school and just seeing like these balls of anxiety that I was my high school peers, everybody just freaking out about what they were gonna do with their life, and I was like, why are you guys freaking out? And I never until later looked back and saw that I knew what I was gonna do, and I never had any doubt.
That's a real gift.
It's a
and I didn't realize it at the time either, but like I knew from when I was pretty young that what I wanted to do. I didn't know I was going to do it, but that's what I wanted to do.
Exactly.
And there's so many people, I'm sure it's true for everybody, no matter where you grow up, but so many people just kind of go through life and never figure that shit out.
Yeah, and that, to me, that bums me out. And no matter how tired I get or anything, I always think back to that, how truly blessed I am to do what I love, and I let people know that every night. It's a reminder to me and to the fans that it's a blessing to do what I'm good at, to have something that I truly love to be in my career. And I knew that in high school, and when I was 17, I was having trouble with the truancy courts.
I don't know if you're familiar with that. Was they trying to throw you in detention center and shave your head or something?
Yeah, it was fucked. It was Piedmont,
Dude, was your
South
hair
Carolina.
Like this at that point?
Yeah.
That would have been real. Yeah. That would have been a real threat.
They had a problem with me because I was, they thought I was just a dropout, and I smoked pot and I played rock and roll music. And I wore Birkenstocks, you know what I mean? So
oh, shit. It was the Birkenstocks.
It's the Birkenstocks.
Above all, not so much the weed or the dropping out.
Yeah, and the hemp necklace didn't do me any favors either. In this high school, I mean, everybody I'm sure was nice enough, but I didn't like them. They didn't like me. Mm. We just didn't get along. It was cool.
Was there nobody else that was sort of into what you were into?
Yeah, there was not really anybody digging what I was doing. Or what I was into. Nobody there even knew I played music because I kind of kept it quiet. Some of the teachers did because I'd be playing downtown and they'd come out. I'd see my teachers cutting loose at my gigs. Right. And they wouldn't realize till second set that it was me. It was kind of funny.
That's why you never show up to class.
A few moments. But that's what ended up happening is I sleep in class all day because I knew what I wanted to do. And I was a terrible student just because I didn't want to be there. And I would wear them down, man. I'd be like, look, dude, I don't want to be here. Just let me sit in the back. I'm not going to pay attention. I don't give a shit what you're
saying. I'm not
going
to pay attention, but I don't want to fuck up your class. So
and
just...
it got rough. A lot of them, I would break down and they'd be like, whatever. I don't even care anymore. And finally, when I was 17, and just to be fair, half the day was spent studying jazz theory, and I really gave a shit about that.
Right.
I loved it.
Were you, like, getting straight A's in those classes and F's and everything else?
Yeah. And it wasn't due to, like, lack of ability in the academic studies. It was just lack of interest. Mm. So when I was 17, I was like, they're going to try to kick me out of school. It's going to be ugly. They're going to try to put me in court for truancy just because I was late so many times. And finally, when 17 rolled around, I was old enough to drop out of high school. And they tried to tell me I was going to end up in prison and all this shit. And I was like, I disagree. I don't think I'm going to end up in prison because I just want to play guitar.
Well, in fairness, the jury's still out on that one. Now, come on. You got a lot of time left to wind up there.
It can still happen. A good friend of mine in Nashville is a publisher. He said he found out how old I was. This was when I first met him. I was actually with Ronnie Bowman, and he said, damn, Bowman. He can make 10 years of mistakes and still have a decent country career.
That's where I'm like, where do you, this is totally off topic from what we're just talking about, but where do you see yourself kind of genre wise?
Mm. It's tough, man. People,
because on top of which, like, what defines country? He could have a good country, make 10 years of mistakes and have a good country career. Like,
right.
Is that somewhere you see yourself going musically?
I love country music. I saw your Opry sign. I've got one of those. I'll be back on the Opry later this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. And it's just such a blessing doing that.
It's so fun.
Because I love that music. That's what my grandfather showed me, and
I could not believe how nice everybody was.
Such sweethearts.
I did a couple times last year. It just blew my the first time, especially like the security guard at the back gate was like, "Welcome to the Opry for your debut."
Here's your goodie bag.
How do you know that?
Yeah, they're so nice, and I'm happy to be going back doing it again. But I mean, I don't like to lean all the way into one thing.
Right.
I've been straddling a lot of lines. And the hard part is if you don't say what you are, someone will say it for you.
Right.
And then it kind of becomes a false narration.
Right.
And that's how I became a blues musician without ever saying I was a blues musician. So now I'm trying to rewrite the story with this quote-unquote Americana record.
Right.
Which I love American roots music. Anything that was born from American soil and that just kind of started here.
I feel like Americana just keeps adding other sort of guitar, bass, and drums based roots music to its gigantic collective. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like
it's R&B. It's old. It's honky tonk. It's blues. It's rock and roll. It's just kind of everything now.
Well, we saw that with the jam scene,
right? You know, is that you kind of came up in the jam scene?
I came up in the jam scene because they had John Scofield in the jam scene, and they had the Wood Brothers, and they had bluegrass acts. It was just it's just a mixed bag when you're there, and everything's welcomed. You go to a jam
bluegrass
festival.
The shred of country music.
Yeah, exactly.
It's insane. Yeah. All those guys are like Yngwie Malmsteen on a mandolin.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Sam Bush, man.
Totally. Did, like, when you were writing the stuff for this new record, did Auerbach turn you on to a bunch of stuff that you hadn't been listening to prior to that? Because there definitely seems to be like a, like it leans a little more, I don't know, sort of like nasty, spooky 70s R&B, almost like, sounds like it could be like a Quentin Tarantino soundtrack kind of thing. You know what I mean? There's right. a bit of that in there.
I mean, we'd get into like ZZ Hill and Tony Joe White,
yeah.
Dan Penn, and we ended up doing a track where I kind of like do a little spoken word, and we had to spend, this was the only thing that I was like, I don't know. I don't want to do that.
Right.
He was like,
I am not doing a poetry slam.
Yeah. I was like, Tony Joe White sounded like the inner, he sounded like the interior of a swamp. That's
right.
Why he was
yes.
speaking.
Yes.
People like to hear it.
Yeah.
It's like butter.
Yeah. It sounded like that was just like barely what he could get out.
Yeah.
You know?
He just nonchalant. And I was like, I don't have that.
Right.
So we ended up having to find my voice, which was, that was the only challenge that I had, really. And also, like, working with that band, it was intimidating.
Yeah.
Because if I didn't get something, like, we cut 18 songs in 3 days.
18 songs?
We
could
have cut more.
Shit.
I was the weak link as far as my knowledge of reading a chart. They just, they have 50 years right. more experience.
That Nashville number system thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they also, it was pretty funny, Bubba, Gene Chrisman, we did this track called The Well, and we sent him out there to do like some hand clapping, like just that kind of thing. And he was like, I don't need my chart. And he said, Bubba, you're just doing the same
just
thing.
Just clap, man.
Just clap. And he's like, I'd be more comfortable if I... And we had to find it. And then we got it. And he got out there, and our buddy leaned over to me and said, Bubba won't take a shit without his chart. That's good.
So the album comes out this Friday. Well, by the time I put this up, the album will be long since out. But
it's out.
It's out, people. Go listen to it. So what's next for you? Are you just hitting the road?
Yeah, that's it, man. This whole year is just on the road.
Is it booked up? Like, you getting to know what you're doing? It's all laid out
yeah.
in front of you?
And I like that.
That's a great feeling.
Super OCD kind of guy.
Yeah.
And knowing what I'm doing until December just is good for me.
Outside of, you know, the sort of obvious stuff, playing music and art and blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
that is really the thing I love the most about, you know, doing this for a living. It's that sort of like, you just, there's a momentum to it.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep kind of one foot in front of the other, and you don't have to think about it. It's just,
exactly.
it's always there.
It's kind of, yeah. It's just kind of like working in a factory, man.
Yeah.
You know, as long as that conveyor belt's working,
yeah.
you know what to do with your hands. And this year is just kind of that. It's just a lot of working and trying to make steps forward, you know, and we're going to get back in the studio. We're going to be cutting a live record.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Get back in the studio. You just cut 18 songs. What do you need to get back in the studio for?
I got to do another Marcus King band record, man.
Okay.
And
are you going to do that with Auerbach as well?
Potentially.
Hmm.
It's beautiful. That's my favorite part about it. There's so many possibilities
yeah.
for it right now, and we're going to see where it lands.
Certainly no shortage in Nashville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Cool, man. Well, thank you for coming down and doing this today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You are welcome to play a song if you want. Some people do, some people don't. It's not required. It's
sure.
totally your call.
Let's play one.
All right.
I'm trying to get my voice back right now. I guess I'll do one off the record we've been talking about. It's a song called Break, and we wrote it with Bobby Woods. And just the chordal structure on this is a little different. It's pretty indicative of writing with a keyboard player. They kind of have a different way of saying it. And this song called Break, it's just about two broken people kind of being together, I guess. It's like this.
Mm-hmm.
you're calling. Don't you mistake it for me. You're falling apart, but don't let your heart break for nobody but me. Got us all guessing who you'll be blessing. Everyone's waiting to see. You think you're so smart, but don't let your heart break for nobody but me. Funny how this town can't forget you. Sooner or later you'll see I'll always be there to catch you. Somebody's shaking your tree. Don't let your heart break for nobody but me. It's 4 in the morning. You think that I'm fast asleep, alone in the dark, but don't let your heart break for nobody but me. Alone in the dark, but don't let your heart break for nobody, ache for nobody, break for nobody but me.
Yeah, you got a guitar lesson. Thank you.
Shit.
Yeah, that was Marcus King showing me some new tricks on the old six string. What a cool dude. Fun chat. Make sure you get out there and listen to his new record, El Dorado, out now, produced by Dan Auerbach. As always, go to walkingthefloor.com and we'll put up some links so you can track all of Marcus King's movements. That's it for this week. I'm going to be back in a couple of weeks. I think with my buddy Luke Dick, who was in here recently. Luke Dick, songwriter from Nashville, who's just recently made a really cool documentary sort of about his mom's work life. Well, we'll get into it when I'm back. That's it for this week, folks. Adios, amigos!